shotglassdigital.com. Rebel Force Radio is brought to you in part by Little Debbie Snacks, bakers of all galactic goodness, like mini donuts, Star Crunch, cosmic cupcakes, cosmic brownies, nutty bars, and much more. It's all about celebrating your love of a galaxy far, far away. And Little Debbie is the fan's choice for all those sweet moments. Little Debbie, official snack of Rebel Force Radio, Rancho Obi-Wan, and fans around the galaxy. DorksideToys.com. For the latest Star Wars action figures, Marvel, G.I. Joe, and more, visit DorksideToys.com.
A small rebel force has penetrated the shield and landed on Endor.
This is where the fun begins.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
This is Rebel Force Radio.
Your source for the Force.
Star Wars news and commentary.
With Jason Swank and Jimmy Mack.
I've seen Star Wars 500 times.
Star Wars number one.
This station is now the ultimate power in the universe. I suggest we use it.
Now it's time for Rebel Force Radio.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Well, I can tell you one thing we won't be talking about this week. Toy Fair.
Oh.
What happened to Toy Fair? There's an investigative report. Someone go find it. I thought it was supposed to be this past week. And, I don't know, we got a Furby. And we got... Did we get anything else? I don't really know. We got a bunch of lightsabers that clicked together. Which actually, I gotta say, it was kind of cool, but... no big revelations, certainly nothing out there with Force Awakens on it. I don't know that we were really expecting that, but it, you know, like a mail away or an announcement of a mail away would have been good. I guess I'm talking old school for some of you fans out there, but we used to have to mail away for our action figures. We had to collect proofs of purchase, and we'd get them in these little baggies, and I just remember the smell. the action figure in the back. Anyway, so we won't be talking about Toy Fair. You'll have to check out another podcast for that, because there really wasn't a whole lot in terms of Star Wars news. But that's not going to stop us. We have a great show this week. And here to help me out with all of that, my good friend and yours from Chicago. He didn't go to Toy Fair. Nope. Jimmy Mack.
Hey, Jason Hayes, Star Wars fans. Yeah, the news coming out of the New York Toy Fair was very much a bummer. But I just think that the effort is really being made to close the clamp down on any sort of merchandise for The Force Awakens getting out there too early. You know how JJ is, that reputation he has. Jason, I believe he did sort of interfere with the release of Star Trek toys back in the a few years ago when he was directing those films.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, the story was that he was so hesitant to release any kind of reference material for the film, for the toy manufacturers or the licensees, that it held up production, which then held up getting them to market. They were rushed to market. Anybody who remembers the Star Trek figures and some of the sets that came out for that first movie realize that they looked rushed. And there were also several books that were shelved that were written but then not released, and the novelization didn't come out in actual paper form, hard copy form, for a long time. It was kind of a mess due to that shroud of secrecy. And you'll notice when that Star Trek Into Darkness film came out, there was like no merch because nobody wanted to touch it.
Wow.
How can you not make money? I mean, I know this is a Star Wars podcast, but, you know, I mean, Star Trek is no stranger to merchandise. And... do you see any merchandise with the new crew? Not much.
Not at all. Yeah. You know, it's crazy. I don't really want to be waving red flags and reporting that this is actually happening, because that would be us definitely putting the cart ahead of the horse. And I think that the strong tradition of Star Wars merchandise, collectibles, toys, action figures, I think that will be in place by the time The Force Awakens is released, and in the wake of that.
I have no doubt. But
right.
But Jim, would it have been, you know, too much to hope for the announcement of a mail-away figure at this point?
Oh, it doesn't appear that that's the direction they're going in. I read a Q&A with Hasbro just earlier this week, and they said that that definitely is not happening.
Really?
There's not going to be a pre-film mail-away figure. There's not going to be...
That's a first. That is a first since Empire Strikes Back.
No, Empire, you had Boba Fett.
No, I mean, I should say since Empire Strikes Back. I mean, since Empire Strikes Back, there's been a mail-away figure for every film.
Right.
Or some sort of early bird.
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it doesn't appear we'll be getting that, nor will there be an exclusive for Star Wars Celebration from Hasbro. So some traditions dying hard, but I'm not ready to bury them yet. Hopefully they'll come back once the film franchise gets up and going again, because right now this is it's kind of scramble time for people behind the scenes, I'm sure. So as the machine gets restructured and it starts rolling along, I hope things will come together as far as figures.
You know, and as we were discussing offline, that really Toy Fair, I think that the whole industry, particularly those that cater towards genre licenses, I think Toy Fair is shifting, and a lot of the real exciting announcements, not just for Star Wars, but for any of the big genre brands, is at San Diego Comic-Con. That seems to be now, I think, the real center of the universe. It comes at a time when they can announce the big fourth quarter assortments of toys going into the holiday season. So maybe we're being a little hard on, you know, Hasbro and just pointing them out specifically, but it just seemed pretty lackluster all around, I think.
Plus, maybe we'll get some announcements at Star Wars Celebration about.
I definitely think so. Would you say we'll see more? I mean, I think they'd be crazy not to use that as the platform to launch this stuff, and then wait another couple months and do it at San Diego. Don't you?
Yeah, it sounds like a good plan to me. So why blow it all now at Toy Fair? Sit on it. Wait until Star Wars Celebration. So that's a good call, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that that info will be revealed at the show, perhaps on the behind-the-scenes stage.
Wouldn't that be something? But Toy Fair or no, we have a great show coming up. We have a fascinating guy joining us, Mike Climo. And Mike has a website out there that's sort of a website / essay, StarWarsRingTheory.com, and he breaks down in a super detailed way the Star Wars film saga and how it, he believes, is structured around an ancient storytelling technique called ring theory. And so he'll be talking to us, and we'll be discussing that, as well as how and if George Lucas was even aware that he was doing this. But it's great, especially for you out there that are questioning, you know, what was George thinking of with the prequels? What was it? Was it just random? This will make you think twice about that. Also, George Lucas was out at Sundance Film Festival. Jim, I noticed he waited a year that you weren't there.
Yeah, I think that was done purposely, of course. you know, he wanted to avoid us at all costs. Uh-huh. Also, Ewan McGregor at Sundance this year, too. Who did I get? Phil Rudd or Paul Rudd, whatever his name is?
Paul Rudd's funny guy.
He's a funny guy, but he's no Obi-Wan Kenobi or the Maker.
Yeah, right.
You know, this was the year to go to Sundance. But no, we had a great time last year supporting the Roger Ebert documentary, Life Itself, featuring the vocal talents of Steven Stanton.
Yeah, and that's now on home videos. You can catch that on iTunes, and I believe it's out. I think it's out on hard disk now.
No, I think it's going to be coming out very soon. But yeah, you can get it. There's many ways to see it now. It's been on CNN several times. Totally got screwed out of the Oscar nomination again. Bad news for director Steve James, but it's a fantastic film and definitely worth checking out. And you'll be amazed at the work Steven does in the film. You'll really think that Roger Ebert himself is telling his life story. That's how deadly accurate the vocal work of Steven Stanton is when mimicking, for lack of a better term, Roger Ebert in that film. But George is at Sundance, and he was up on stage with Robert Redford. We actually have audio highlights from that, and a lot more. We got our famous 15-minute The Force Awakens spoiler alert coming up.
We heard you. We heard you. Yes. I know. We missed it last week. We teased it at the beginning. We didn't have time. We ran out of time, but we've got it this week. But to kick things off, we're going to kick things off with a bang. Jimmy Mack was fortunate enough to catch up with the head writer for Star Wars Rebels, a guy we haven't heard from in a while, but it's so great to have him back in the Star Wars universe, Henry Gilroy. So joining Jimmy Mack in the cantina, Star Wars Rebels head writer, Henry Gilroy.
Where are you going, Master?
For a drink.
Sorry about the mess.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
Hey, Henry.
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing, man?
Good, good. Long time no chat.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that. I've missed our chats.
Absolutely. I mean, my God, the last time I've seen you in person was when we had lunch in Long Beach, I believe.
Oh, my gosh. Was that like 5 years ago or something like that?
I don't think it was that long ago. Feels like
four years ago. Okay.
Well, enough has happened within that time frame to kind of justify it seeming like it was a long time ago, because you certainly have been super busy with Star Wars.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's like even that, just kind of the last couple years, really. And it's been a fantastic ride to get back into it.
Yeah, right. Of course, like if our listeners don't realize, you've been writing for Star Wars going back to, I believe, your first foray into the galaxy far, far away was by doing the comics adaptation for The Phantom Menace for Dark Horse.
That was like probably the second or third thing. I'd actually done a couple of short stories for Randy Stradley at Dark Horse, I think in probably 95 or 94 or something like that. So, yeah, it's going on 20 years. I've been working on Star Wars on and off. And, it's been a great pleasure. You know, it's very rare that I think anyone in their creative endeavor has the opportunity to kind of work in the story. I was going to say the story actually that inspired, you know, me to get in the business. And obviously, you know, I owe that to George. So I've been very fortunate that way.
Yeah, it's been a long road to Rebels. Of course, you were I believe you were the original head writer for The Clone Wars.
Yes. Uh-huh. I developed that series with Dave and George back in 2005. And I was, you know, there for the first season and a half probably. The first 30-some-odd episodes or whatever, and then George brought me back for season 4 to write an arc. It was really fun.
Yeah, that arc was the Slaver's arc.
Exactly.
Yes. I think that was the last time we talked to you. The Slaver's arc happened. So that was the last time you worked in Star Wars prior to Rebels, and then Rebels got up off the ground, and they brought you back.
How about that? Yeah, that actually was great. You know, and I really probably owe that to Dave. And I'd actually worked with Greg Wiseman, the season one executive producer on the series, and in various other series in animation. But really, I think it was Dave who said, "Hey, you know what? We should bring Henry back to, bring his sensibility to it." And I think partially why was, you know, people ask like what prepares you to work on Rebels, like how do you get to that point? And I go, well, you know, as a storyteller, George was my inspiration. So even though I've kind of gone off in the meantime and worked on G.I. Joe and Transformers over here in Kaijudo, and then I went to Marvel for a couple of years and worked on Hulk and Spider-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy, really working with Dave and George, like on a daily basis, that's really what prepares you to work on a show like Rebels. Even though when I wasn't working on Rebels, I would talk to Dave regularly and I didn't get to hear the secret stuff anymore. But after an episode was on, you know, I'd have my own like Rebels recap or not my Rebels recap, but my Clone Wars, you know, I'd call up and go, oh, those guys are going to get you for this, that, and the other, you know? But it was great fun because I never lost touch with Star Wars.
Oh, for sure. And well, I mean, it's always been obvious as long as I've known you two guys that you and Dave Filoni have a great relationship together. You guys work really well together. You sort of speak the same language as Star Wars fans, and you oftentimes approach it from unique directions that when you guys bring it all together, it really adds up to awesome storytelling.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for that. And what's weird is I've realized that people ask about that. Like, how do you do that? How does that happen? And for me, it's really about surrendering my ego as far as working on Star Wars. I think, you know, when you work on Star Wars, you can't go, I'm going to make it Henry Gilroy Star Wars. It's really, I'm in service to a mythology that's much larger than myself. I just happen to be the steward who's telling these stories the way George did and collaborating with Dave to really carry on and bring the spirit of the stories to life. You know, people ask about that, like, you know, how do you go about, like, just coming up with stories? And you go, well, Star Wars in my mind is the cinema stew that George created. Part classic Western, part samurai movie, part Flash Gordon serial mixed with swashbuckling, you know, pirate adventure. And then there's even, like, Warner Brothers cartoons humor. So when you have to, like, add a dash of this and a pinch of that to really kind of get that spirit. And it's very difficult to do it. And that's something kind of we found with even bringing in new writers is that people are really good at mimicking it. But can you create something that's new but yet feels like Star Wars? And I think there's probably nobody better at that than Dave.
Yeah.
Because he studied with George for 8 years.
Well, you did too. And I always recall that George was often saying that he was training the next generation to create Star Wars. So, I mean, yeah. that's an awesome position for you guys to be into because you were right there to take the baton from him and run with it. But do you ever find that to be too restrictive, or do you know how to work your way around in the formula so well at this point that it's almost academic?
No, you know, I don't think so. You know, and I think, you know, that's something that I really think when, you know, you think about Rebels having a slightly new flavor and a different feel, I think that's the Lucasfilm's new story group. You know, Keri Hart, Carrie Beck, Rain Roberts, you know, Pablo Hidalgo, they actually are open to new ideas and bringing new stuff in. So maybe if I'm even a little stickler going, well, that's not how George would do it, I think there is the open of like, well, hey, we can do this somewhat different. I think we really always try to keep certain tenements, you know, commandments that George did. But I think they're open to building Star Wars wider. So it doesn't have to just be what it has been, but it can be something new and exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think Rebels really does that. I think Ezra's a really interesting new character. And I think, you know, we've never seen a character quite like Kanan before. You know, Sabine and Hera really are powerful female characters that we have not seen in animation before. And I think there's a whole new generation of fans who are discovering these characters in Star Wars and going, wow, this is awesome. And it's a brand new Star Wars world we're creating.
Yeah, the fans are really starting to connect with the characters of Rebels. And you know what? I should even say starting to, because I think the fans were connecting with the characters before we even saw any episodes. Just, you know, judging by the reaction they got at events like Star Wars Weekends at Disney. Do you have a particular favorite Rebels character, especially when you approach it from like a writing standpoint? Who's fun to write for?
You know, it's entirely dependent on the story. I get asked this on every show I've ever worked on. You know, oh, you're working on the Hulk show. Which do you do? Spider-Man shows, G.I. Joe. Who do you like? And it really depends on the story. The story in service of the characters. I tend to be drawn to the Kanan and Ezra-centric episodes. But depending on the story, I love them. And when you think about those stories really kind of focus on, you know, the ones, at least season one I've wrote, which is Old Masters and Empire Day, Visions of Hope, and the upcoming Rebel Resolve, there is a sense of Ezra's journey. And I've, you know, was really kind of imprinted by George into writing the hero mythic stories. And I always try to explore those themes, you know, the little guy against the big bad guys, stories about the fight for freedom. independence. And I think that's something that, you know, George tapped into when he kind of, you know, told his little, you know, space wizard story. He really tapped into something that's so primal, the fight for freedom and independence, that we just keep telling that story again and again, and we love that story. So I'm fortunate to, you know, be in a situation where I can continue to add to the mythology that he started.
You know, Ezra is such a compelling character, and it seems like the series itself is told from his perspective. And what I think makes him so compelling, Henry, is the fact that you have a character who has a deep connection to the rebellion via his parents, who we are gradually beginning to learn a little, you know, little taste of who they were and what they were all about, especially with the episode Empire Day, which you wrote. It was revealed that they were openly transmitting anti-imperial propaganda. So Ezra's compelling because he does have his roots in the rebellion, but he also is connected to the Force. So you have this two-pronged attack coming with this character that I don't think we've ever really seen in Star Wars before. Have we ever seen a character so connected to the origin of the rebellion and so connected to the Force? I guess Kanan would, but I mean, this is Ezra's life. This is where Ezra comes from.
Right. And even Kanan, you know, you kind of get the sense that he was really kind of detached from his connection to the Force until Ezra came into his life. So I think that's a really interesting, element that we're able to explore. And I think even with Luke, you know, he was kind of like not attached to anything. He had sort of, you know, Force things, but really that's something that he didn't even realize. You don't even realize it until like halfway through the movie. And then at the end, does he really kind of demonstrate it, where we're really showing this character who's part of, you know, something that, you know, is building towards a rebellion. And which, you know, isn't really a rebellion, really, when you think about it. It's just a group of people who are sort of fighting back against the Empire. So, yeah, I think there hasn't been anything in the literature, which is awesome. But I also think it's a really great way to introduce people to the whole Star Wars pantheon and mythology, at least the original trilogy. And especially when you think about like Episode 7, where that goes, I think Rebels is a fantastic gateway Star Wars drug for a new audience.
Really? So interesting that you know where Episode 7 goes.
No, wait a minute. I did not say that. I did not make a connection to Episode 7. I did not. Well, I mean, the idea of those original characters, those original trilogy characters, kind of being reintroduced to the world. When you think about it, last time we saw them in the movies was 86.
Yeah.
83. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. 83. Gosh, yeah. I was thinking about something else. But yeah. Think about that. I mean, that's a lot of years.
Yeah.
It's a lot of years.
Yeah.
So, I think that what we're saying, through Rebels is there's room in the entire timeline for all sorts of stories and all sorts of characters.
Yeah. Yeah. We're seeing that for sure. And, we have been seeing it even, you know, throughout the Clone Wars and the prequel era. And it's just great to see that storytelling tradition continue, because those dark years between the end of Revenge of the Sith and the beginning of A New Hope were always very fertile ground. And now you guys are actually able to start putting your fingerprints on that era. And what I enjoy about Rebels, and I think a lot of people find the appeal in the show, because it has that familiar original trilogy feel. So after coming off the Clone Wars, now you sort of have to shift into that flavor, that tone. And so how was it making that shift from Clone Wars into Rebels?
That's something that I think is a challenge to even talk about, because, you know, what you ideally want to do is show in this period, because this is like pre-Luke, you know, pre-Han, there really isn't a rebellion, like you were saying. So if anything, you're trying to do something that sort of bridges the gap, you know, and you know, having Lando in an episode you know, is something that does that. Having the voice of Yoda in an episode is something that we can do to kind of bridge the two films in such a way that we haven't really seen before. And I think, at least not in television, in the cinematic form. So I think that's really key to actually work to bridge both the prequel era and into the original trilogy. So as far as, in my mind, Star Wars is Star Wars. I never think about, like, oh, I'm changing gears. There are some Star Wars stories that are grim, and there are some stories that are mystical, and there are some stories that are fun and farcical. And that's the great thing about what George created is that we can tell any kind of story. When you watch it, you know, and that's I really think that's why there's, you know, all the seasons of Clone Wars that there are, is because there are so many different kinds of stories. And I know that some people like, you know, the really dark and violent ones, but then there are other people who really love the Yoda episodes. And, you know, there was a kid one time at a convention that came up to me and said, I love the episode where Jar Jar is, like, bossing around the clones. And I think there's room in Star Wars to tell any kind of story we want to, whether they be samurai stories or Western stories, or like I was saying. So, no, I don't really think about it like changing gear so much. There was a seriousness to Clone Wars because we knew what was going to happen. We knew there were characters that we were not going to kill off. And I think that does limit you in your storytelling, because you you do limit, you know, where you can go, where your imagination can go. We know that certain things can't happen just because nature of it. So I think when you're dealing with a whole new set of characters who you don't know their fates, I think their ultimate fates and destinies can be anything and can go anywhere. And I think that's exciting.
And it also is a great example of just how flexible the franchise can be and all the different directions you can push it into. And that's something I think keeps Star Wars fans coming back for more, because if every week it was a repeat of essentially what we saw in A New Hope, it would get to be a little old. So I'm glad to see that you guys have the cojones to step outside the box from time to time and breathe some fresh air into the franchise. So it's not just the same old week in and week out. And I
got to tell you this, Jimmy, your head's going to explode for season two. I can say that, right, Tracy, that his head's going to explode.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
Okay. Head explodes. So big spoiler alert. My head is going to explode.
Spoiler alert. You're going to lose your mind.
Well, I'll tell you what, Henry.
Yeah. You're going to be at Celebration, right?
Yes, of course.
So you got to tell everyone come to Celebration and you have your brains splattered all over the place. Cause it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can't wait. So, can't wait for you guys to see.
Of course, the season two premiere will be happening during Star Wars Celebration in just a couple months in Anaheim. So I hope we're going to be seeing you there, Henry.
Absolutely. You certainly will.
Excellent. Excellent. A couple quick questions I got to throw at you before you have to run off to your meeting with Dave Filoni in 10 minutes. By the way, pass along our best to Mr. Filoni.
I will.
And Chopper, do you guys ever actually write dialogue for Chopper and then it sort of gets repurposed in the audio department? Or, is there something you put in the script that says Chopper says...
Absolutely.
This.
He gets lines of dialogue just like everybody else. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, you can tell when he's like sassing off.
Oh, yes.
I didn't do it, or, you know, go sit and spin or whatever, you know. So it's that sort of fun stuff. You know, I think that he's generally cantankerous sort. You know, so when they put the sounds in, they're definitely, you know, Chopper's Chopper. So, I think he's quickly becoming a household name. I don't know if you're probably aware of it, but everybody loves Chopper.
Everyone loves Chopper. Come on, he was on America's Funniest Home Videos, for crying out loud. I mean, but no, I saw the love for Chopper during Star Wars weekends in Orlando, and you know, nobody had seen a single episode with this droid in it, but boy, they sure were thrilled to see him. And so the awareness was really there. And and I like that. You know, one thing that has always kind of been a mystery to me is your time at Hasbro. Did you actually work on the Star Wars line when you were with Hasbro?
No, I had nothing to do with the toys. I worked for Hasbro Entertainment.
Uh-huh.
So I was working on story editing.
With the G.I. Joe, right, right.
Yeah, G.I. Joe Renegades. I worked on Kaijudo there. I worked on Transformers. So I worked on their various toy properties, but I didn't work with anything to do with Star Wars, except I would occasionally beg for the toys, but I would sometimes get them and most times not.
I remember you talking about you and Filoni in the early days working on Clone Wars. Nobody knew what you were working on. It was top secret. And you guys would go over to Toys R Us and stand in the toy aisle and look at Star Wars action figures for, I assume, some level of inspiration to come off of them.
Yeah, and I think that's a part of it. I think it's the love, that you have for it, and seeing your characters. You know, I do remember, actually after we were working on the show for 2 years, going into that same Toys R Us and, like, seeing the Ahsoka, this character that we created with George.
Wow.
On the peg. And it was like, oh, my gosh, I created a Star Wars character that's like a figure. George did that, but nobody else really did that. I guess occasionally, there were comic book, later on there were comic book characters who were turned into figures, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, our love for it. And I think that when you kind of look at even, all of our crew, top to bottom, the artists and animators, they have a love for the design of the prequels, but as well as the McQuarrie design. So you're seeing that translated into Rebels in a way that makes you, oh yeah, this is what Star Wars feels like. This is what it looks like. And I know you probably know the technical aspects of, Dave and his directors using the same lenses.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And taking very care for the sound effects. So top to bottom, everybody has this huge commitment to excellence. Everyone's on the same page about making something great, and it's a good enough to be Star Wars. It's great, we talk about like what's the same working with Killian Plunkett, I worked with on Clone Wars and Athena, as well as Dave. There's this continuity to Star Wars that assures the quality that we all know that Star Wars deserves. That's really something that's 6 p.m. comes along here at the studio and just about everybody is still at their desk working hard to make the show the best it can be. So that's something that, having worked at other studios, I don't necessarily see that same commitment to make something that's transcendent. And so you see the love go into Star Wars. And I think that's why you watch an episode of Rebels, people say like, oh, yeah, I watched this 3 times already. And there's a reason why. Because the craft that goes into making every episode is by a huge amount of people, Tracy too, to make it great.
Oh, that's great. And all those names you mentioned are probably sitting in a conference room waiting for you right now. So I don't want to hold you up any further. But, hey, Henry, it's been great to catch up with you. It's been too long, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you in Anaheim for Star Wars Celebration. We will be hosting the behind-the-scenes stage. So I hope you can pop in for a few and hang out with us for a little while.
I absolutely will. Tracy will tell me where to go, and I will be there and harass you guys.
Awesome.
But thanks for calling, and
yes.
and best to everyone listening out there, and stay tuned to Rebels, and just know there's awesome stuff coming down the pike.
Yes, can't wait. We're talking about head exploding for season 2.
Head exploding.
Yes, looking forward to it. All right, Henry, take care. Thank you so much for checking in with us.
Thank you, Jimmy.
This is Carrie Fisher.
Hey, Jake Lloyd here.
Hello, this is Warwick Davis, and you're listening to Rebel Force Radio.
Now this is podcasting.
This is Anthony Daniels, and they asked me to throw in an ad-lib, but they didn't throw in any money, so I'm not going to throw in anything else. Goodbye.
Hey, it's James Earl Taylor, the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I must tell you, the source for the Force is Rebel Force Radio, your source for the Force.
Hey, it's Mark Hamill, that Skywalker guy from those space movies.
Rebel Force Radio, what an unfortunate moniker.
Force yourself to listen.
I have good news for you, my lord.
That's good news.
Come closer, I have good news.
That was Mark on another podcast?
Yeah.
Mark Hamill? He's doing podcasts? Other than ours?
Only the connected ones, yeah.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, Mark Hamill was on Schmoes No, episode 182. Recently, I just can't believe that the star of, or one of the stars of The Force Awakens is out there doing podcasts. I love that about Mark, though. You know, you haven't seen hide nor hair, really, of Harrison Ford since filming Wrapped. Carrie Fisher has only made just a couple of appearances. But Mark's out there, and he's talking Star Wars.
He's promoting Kingsman.
That's right. That's so right. He's got that cameo.
It's out there. Right, right. And so the guys over at the Schmoes, they had an inside contact with Mark via his son, Nathan. So that's the benefit.
Well, we know him.
Yeah, well, we...
I mean, not that well, but I mean...
Yeah, he quit talking to us when we asked him if he wanted to be on the show, Nathan. no, Nathan's actually a nice guy. As a matter of fact, I remember one time we were with Mark in Japan, and Mark was naming the characters from the cantina, and he and from Return of the Jedi, too, from Jabba's Palace, and he's like, do they really have a character named Calamari? And it was just funny because then Nathan was there. Yeah, Dad, that's Admiral Akbar. What about the guy who's... Dad, that was Ponda Baba. So it just went on. So Nathan's a big Star Wars fan, and he's connected with these podcasters that Schmoes know. At least he has some sort of connection with them. They revealed on the air. And I listened to their podcast. It was my first time listening to Schmoes, and I enjoyed them. I think they're likable guys. I think they're based out in L.A., so they have that luxury of convenience by being, you know, you and me, Jason, we're landlocked out here in the mighty Midwest, freezing our...
Oh, my God, it's like an ice tundra around here. I don't know how it is there, but it's just relentless. The cold, the snow doesn't melt. It's ice.
Yep, but that does not deter us from bringing you Star Wars news and conversation each and every week.
No.
So they did have Mark on the phone talking Kingsman, but the conversation did turn towards Star Wars after a while. And they talked a little bit about, well, they filled Mark in and what's considered canon nowadays and what isn't. But to get to the real meat, the real good stuff, let's go to a section toward the end of the interview. I have a couple highlights pulled aside here. And this is Mark talking about having reservations about returning back to Star Wars. He was a little nervous about coming back as Luke Skywalker until the events played out that made it a perfect situation for him to come back.
My first instinct was, as always, don't try and toy with what was good and nice and fun. I mean, I didn't... I never expected they would go back to these characters. I mean, I thought it wouldn't be out of the question to do more episodes, but certainly focus on a new generation. And in a way, it sort of is. I mean, it's about the new generation, and we're, you know, I mean, I think we give perspective. I mean, it gives you scope of the... I mean, I think it's... George always envisioned seeing these characters, you know... grow and age and be different than they were before. But I thought, you know, it's too high risk. I mean, it's going to be great no matter what. So, you know, why mess with that? And I thought, well, I won't do it unless everybody else is on board. You know, if Harrison doesn't want to do it, if Perry doesn't want to do it, you know, that was my feeling, because it's all or none.
All or none.
Yeah. And I think it's that feeling that Mark, I mean, Jim, I remember in the lead up to the official announcement that they were returning, there was all that speculation. Harrison was in, then he was out. And then, you know, we had heard that for Mark, it was all or none. And I think it's that spirit that got us where we are. And I mean, the money helps too. But I think it was that kind of, let's all do this, that helped make this happen in terms of bringing those guys back together. So I really think it's important that, you know, Mark was the one that was insisting on that.
Well, I mean, look at it this way. If the story didn't feature Leia or Han at all, and they approached Mark and said, we're just going to focus on Luke and his relationship with the next generation and feature Luke in a real prime plum role. I think Mark would have accepted it in a second. But knowing that Harrison and Carrie, their characters, Han and Leia, are going to be included in The Force Awakens, that was the deal breaker for him. Because he already knew that those all the characters were coming back. So that's when it became all or nothing for Mark Hamill. But I strongly believe if they approached him and said, we're just going to feature Luke. Maybe we'll bring back Han and Leia in episode 8. Then I still think Mark would have been on board with that. I think he would have been on board with that. But just the idea of moving forward with the Star Wars film that was intended to have the big three in it, and maybe only one or two of the big three signed up, then I think Mark would have had issue with that. And so he was holding out, waiting to see primarily what Harrison would do. Let's face it.
That's what everybody was waiting. Yes, I mean, obviously Harrison's dance card is the most full.
Of course, but I don't think that was ever an issue. I think Harrison was in from day one. We have audio evidence to prove that when he was speaking very openly with Dean Richards from WGN Radio. Harrison was in Chicago for a film premiere, and he very openly said to Dean Richards, we all want to come back.
So is the old gang getting back together for sure for Star Wars now? There's so much written about this that nobody seems to know what's true and not.
I think it's almost true. I think, I'm looking forward to it. It's not in the bag yet, but I think it's happening.
It was after that interview when Harrison clammed up. They said, hey, you can't talk about this anymore. And he clammed up. And then we waited and waited and waited for that.
Well, probably because there were negotiations going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, we waited and waited for that cast announcement. And I think that the delay in the cast announcement instantly made us think that they're having a hard time reeling in Harrison. Because he was the one who was most derisive about his character in the years following Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
But I don't think Harrison was ever really an issue. I think he was coming back from the get-go. I think Mark may have held out a little bit, realizing, hey, this is a big opportunity for him to guarantee security for himself and his family, and this is the time. The time is now.
Yeah, they need you more so it's than really you interesting. Know.
Oh, yes, yes. So Mark, of course, continued to talk about working on The Force Awakens, most specifically about the biggest differences between working on a film directed by J.J. Abrams as opposed to working on a film directed by George Lucas.
This is the first of any of the titles that will be helmed by the fan generation. Now, Larry Kasdan is along for the ride, but in terms of the co-writer and the director, it's the first from the fan generation. And I hate to characterize George and caricature him as someone that, is broadly not an actor's director. It's more that he is instinctive, so that when he casts someone in a role, that actor or actress is so close to what he wants that there's not a lot to talk about. He wants to see you do it and then talk about it later. You'll ask him a question. I mean, is Luke sort of like getting jealous of this guy, hitting on the princess all the time? He's getting under my skin. And, just do it. I mean, and, we'll talk about it later. And then, of course, you don't talk about it later. In contrast, J.J. Abrams is much more of an upbeat kind of, he's much more loquacious. He's engaged and he loves the process so much. And George is much more, I think, focused and serious and looking at it from a different perspective.
Could be because George is spending all his own money.
He can't afford to be.
JJ's spending Disney dollars.
George cannot afford to be loquacious at this time.
No, loquacious is expensive.
That's why George always prefers to wear the simple plaid shirt.
Right.
Well, because he's got all of his bucks wrapped up in something else. But, you know, it's funny you bring that up because there was a report that just came out this week naming the top filmmakers as far as wealth in Hollywood. And George, wow, he was way up at the top. Spielberg was up there too. But I think George had a value of over $5 billion. Mm. And I think Steven was more like in the 3.3 billion range.
Aw.
Billions, ladies and gentlemen. Billions. Wow. But George, you know, you're absolutely right about that, Jason. And you can't underestimate that fact is that certainly George Lucas had much more than his reputation on the line when it came to making films. That is what all independent filmmakers go through, because in most cases they are getting a second mortgage on their home. They are maxing out their credit cards and they are draining their bank accounts just so they can see their vision through and present it as a film. You know, George Lucas is very typical of the independent filmmaker, despite his billions. So, and JJ, yeah, you know, the Disney dollars. So he's loosey-goosey on the set, just having fun.
Right. And the other thing is the pressure. Well, believe me, I don't want to say the pressure is not on JJ. There's huge pressure.
Huge.
Huge pressure.
But
it's a known quantity, and they know that there's a certain amount of success that's just going to come with the release of a Star Wars film. If it's a great Star Wars film, then it means mega success. But there's a certain degree of success that comes with it. You know, whereas George, at the time of Episode 4, he had the studio breathing down his neck. He had all his friends saying that the movie was terrible. But I do think it's fascinating. I've not heard that observation made before, that Mark says, whereas George casts those that he believes are so close to what he envisions in the part, it's almost like the distinction between the actor and the character isn't as deep as it might be for some. And so George is just like, well, you're Luke Skywalker, just go do it. I'm going to film it.
Right,
go do it. You're Luke. You know, as opposed to worrying about, you know, that he's putting on, you know, airs or a character. And so and I can imagine that there's a certain degree of challenge with that as an actor. I think the worst part is, you know, a stage actor gets that affirmation every night. The laughs, the silences, the applause, all of that. Whereas when you're a film or a TV actor, you don't have any of that. And so you need, in order to kind of gauge where you are, your instrument is those around you, in particular your director. So your director needs to be in tune with what you're doing and giving you that feedback. And if you're not getting that, then it probably feels very disorienting.
You know, I really love comparing George to JJ on that perspective that you presented, Jason, that George is funding it all. And I, you know, add more pressure to Lucas, and this is a pressure that he created himself, granted, but the pressure of creating as well as funding. Mm. Everyone looked at Lucas for all aspects of the creation of the Star Wars films. The buck stopped there on his desk. It truly did. And that added more pressure to him. Nowadays, JJ has the luxury of Lawrence Kasdan, of producers who are actively involved, of a story group at Lucasfilm that is actively involved. So he is working with a net, whereas George Lucas definitely was not.
That's very true. Very true. So great to hear from Mark Hamill and the Schmoes Know guys. Mark, keep making the rounds. Keep making the rounds. Because, you know, he's kind of it right now as far as Episode 7 news.
There's plenty of stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't.
Oh, no doubt. Hey, speaking of behind the scenes, yes, we got some behind the scenes guys at Lucasfilm and Lucasfilm Animation that deserve some kudos.
Absolutely, Jason. And from a guy who appreciates the sound design in film and Star Wars, I'd just like to congratulate our friends, at Skywalker Sound, specifically Matthew Wood and David Acord, who are good friends of this show, and everyone at Skywalker Sound, especially the team that works on Star Wars Rebels and the team that worked on Star Wars The Clone Wars, because they won big-time awards. They won MPSE, Golden Reel Awards, for both series, Rebels and Clone Wars. The MPSEs are the Motion Picture Sound Editors Awards, and they honor the year's best work in various areas of sound editing, like dialogue and effects and music. And so the guys at Skywalker Sound, adding to their trophy case, which, by the way, did you notice security moving in close to me when we were at ILM and Skywalker Sound, and I kept looking at those awards? I was wondering if that cabinet was unlocked. It would be easy to replace the plaque on some of those awards they have there. I mean, who's going to notice an Emmy missing, really?
Out of all of those, no one.
Nobody's going to. But no, they have so many awards there, and this is going to go into the trophy case. It's the MPSE Golden Reel Awards, richly deserved and earned by Matthew Wood, David Acord, and the entire Skywalker Sound team on Star Wars Rebels and The Clone Wars. Congrats.
All right, G-Level Cannon coming out of Sundance Film Festival. As we said, George was on hand and on stage talking to Robert Redford, actor, director, producer. And, of course, anywhere George goes, he's got to talk Star Wars, whether he's retired or not. And this was no exception.
That's right, Jason. George was at the Sundance Film Festival on stage with Robert Redford. Of course, Robert Redford is the guy. He is Mr. Sundance. He's the guy who actually invented the whole festival. He's the one who put Sundance on the map. And they were participating in a great Q&A called Power of Story, Visions of Independence at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. And it was a Q&A being moderated by film critic Leonard Maltin, and it featured George and Robert on stage talking about various things happening in the film industry today and how it impacts the independent filmmaker. So we're not going to hear from Robert, because last I checked, he wasn't in Star Wars.
No, that's the Robert Redford cast over there.
That's right, the Red cast, the Redford cast. I don't know. But George Lucas at Sundance gave us a little insight into where action figures came from and how licensing Star Wars went down in the early days.
The licensing didn't exist. Just there wasn't such a thing. So, especially in the movie business, a little bit in television, but not in the movie business, because it takes a year or two to make toys. You can't just do it and the movie comes out, and it's out for 6 weeks, and that's the end of it. And a toy has to be out there for 6 months or a year. So nobody wanted to do that stuff. But what I wanted to do, because I assumed, with my experience before, both, well, especially American Graffiti, but they didn't advertise it or anything. They just threw it out there. And I said, I want to be able to build an audience for this thing. So the one thing there was in licensing was posters and T-shirts. And you can make those deals really easy. So I said, if I get the licensing, I can make a whole bunch of T-shirts and posters, and I can send people out to Disneyland and everywhere, and I can advertise the movie. And so, and that obviously, everybody thought I was really brilliant, but I was really just protecting myself. And what happened after that was, the Star Wars came out, then suddenly we went to a toy company, we helped them build these little action figures, not G.I. Joes, you know, and stuff, but little ones. And they became very successful, and we ended up making a lot of money. A little bit on the movie, but mostly on the, you know, movies don't make money. I got news for you.
Yeah.
Oh, he should be at Toy Fair this year.
He's got $5 billion in the bank.
He'd cry if he saw the lack of.
Well, he was. I think George would. I think he would be profoundly affected by this. It's amazing when you put it into this perspective that George Lucas, not only one of the most wealthy and successful filmmakers of all time, but the man just darn about turned the toy industry upside down with the invention of Star Wars toys, which was a very important thing to him, not only just to bring in an added cash flow, which, by the way, he's still kind of scratching his head wondering what hit him to this very day. But it did bring in a lot of cash, and he was also intending the toys to be out there to help market the film.
Yes.
He figured if the kids were playing with the toys, they'd want to go see the movie. And I'm telling you, the formula is just downright brilliant.
It is, but he wanted to create living, breathing billboards for the movie.
Exactly.
And then,
yes,
you know, the toys, you know, I think that they were pitching. Now, I don't know, Charles Lippincott, who has been just tearing it up on Facebook lately. If you're not following Charles, you got to, because every once in a while he just posts something that is so enlightening about the history, the early days of Star Wars.
Yes.
But
it's Star Wars history unfiltered.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
No holds barred.
He just puts the facts out there. You just judge for yourself.
He does that. And he has the documentation to back up what he says. And what's also interesting is a lot of old school industry insiders who worked on Star Wars during the early days are also Facebook members, and they will offer their insights and memories as Charles puts together sort of his history in filmmaking out there on Facebook. It's a really incredible sort of experiment to be watching happen. I don't think we've ever seen this as far as Star Wars is concerned.
No, I mean, someone else would just write a book, and that would be that. But Charles is kind of writing a book in a sense. But, you know, hearing George recalling this, I mean, this is probably the most detailed recounting I've ever heard him give in this format about how the merchandising sort of evolved. But what it sounds as though he tried to get toy companies interested. We know famously Mego, depending on how you pronounce it, passed on the Star Wars license. But he was able, it sounds like, to secure posters and T-shirts. We know how that went. And then by the time the movie became a smash, they had interest, finally. And the interest was from a toy company in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Right.
Kenner. So the toys came out a year later. Because as he says, it takes a while to make those toys.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost a year later, if I remember correctly. I seem to recall having Star Wars action figures in spring of 78 beyond the mail order figures.
Mm-hmm.
But George talks a little more. You know how you said in, gosh, I think it was last week's show, Jason, you commented on George and how he is sort of getting into that part of life where he thinks about the way things are done now and compares them to the way things used to be done. Mm-hmm. And even though he's had a lot to do with the advancement of technology in films, he is kind of turned off by the fact that people go overboard with a lot of the tools he helped develop, and they ignore character and they ignore story. And so he talks about them and refers to them as circus films.
When you get into feature films, television shows, dramatic films, or documentaries, there's more to it than just what I call a circus. A circus is where you just, we used to call it in film school, puppies on a freeway, which is the best way to make a good circus film, is simply to get a basket full of puppies, go out to the freeway, turn the camera on, throw the puppies out in the freeway, and see how long they last, and when one gets hit, then you take another one and throw it out there. And you do that for...
Speaking metaphorically.
You do that for 90 minutes, and yeah, you got a movie. And yeah, it's probably better than most of the movies out there. And that's what a lot of people do. You know, a lot of the movies that you see today basically are circus movies. Mm-hmm. It's like going to a real circus where somebody's walking a tightrope. It doesn't have anything to do with telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
It just has to do with the fact that, gee, let's see how much blood comes out when he splats. Mm-hmm. And... the movie industry has turned into a bit of a circus. Mm-hmm. It always has been there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's now gotten to be more and more circus without any substance behind it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get blamed for a lot of that, but at the end, you know, if you go into Star Wars and take the time to actually see what's going on, there's a lot more substance there than circus.
Wow. Except for the circus poster.
Oh, yes, of course. Drew Struzan.
But wow, I mean, that again, this is really good stuff. This is probably the most, I don't know, Jim, maybe it is the perspective of not, of retirement, you know, of retirement that has given George kind of this, I don't know, this is very open, I feel like. This is the most open I feel like he's been in a long time.
Well, of course, you have to step away sometimes to acquire perspective. Uh-huh. And George is starting to lay down some serious, hardcore perspective on us as he has stepped away. And I always think about how George says, I'm going to retire and I'm going to make experimental films that nobody wants to see. And then I listen to him talking about the Puppies on a Freeway film, and I say to myself, oh, God, I hope that's not the film he's going to make.
From the creator of Star Wars.
In a world where puppies become roadkill, and that's okay with George Lucas.
Puppies on a Freeway. Oh, it's good. Good stuff. Blood.
Okay, so he does have a word of wisdom for the filmmakers of today, and that is to go outside of the ordinary and come up with something fresh and see what happens. No matter how stupid your idea might be, go for it.
The idea that there are answers outside the box, and sometimes you should go take that risk, because it's not much of a risk, really, although you may get embarrassed or something, but otherwise there's no big deal for suggesting something stupid or doing it. But part of it is just to encourage kids to do things or to see things differently. I mean, that's the reason I did Star Wars, was to get kids to realize you don't have to follow the rules. You can tell a fun story, but you don't need to be hampered. If it's a, you know, Star Wars really isn't a science fiction film. It's a fantasy film and a space opera. And I purposely said, well, I don't care about any of this stuff. I'm just going to make a great movie. I'm not going to worry about the rules. I'm not going to worry about science. I'm not going to worry about anything. I'm simply going to do what is entertaining. And especially for young kids. And, you know, when you do that, you know, I'd say a good 10% of the things that are in Star Wars have come to pass, even though they were completely ridiculous and impossible when I made the movie. So no matter what you're doing, if you just say, look, let's just have a good time, and think outside the box, what if big dogs could fly spaceships? And if you fantasize that, you spark their fantasy life, and they say, well, yeah, I can think of all kinds of fun things to think about. And that's what you got to do, because you keep doing it, and you don't take people's words. I grew up in the era, don't trust anybody over 30. And, you know, I still feel that. I still feel that you know, don't trust me. But at the same time, it's you realize that the rules and the dogma and the ideology that people have just brings them down to a very small place. And you don't want to be in that place.
Wow. Wise words from the maker.
You got it. You got it. Good stuff from George Lucas at Sundance. Of course, postponing his appearance by 1 year so he just crossed paths with myself as I stumbled through the streets of Park City, Utah last year. But George was there this year, and really very compelling stuff. Great insight from the maker. And again, he's, you know, leaning up against that table there during the family reunion. Say, let me tell you, Bobby, about how things were done in the old days. It was better. And, But the thing is, though, is that he had so much to do with the advancement of the technology today. He's leaning back saying, no, that's not how you do it. You know, he's seriously, he knows how he thinks that technology should be applied. And he has some very firm stances on that. So it's always great to hear from George. That's why we do G-Level Canon here at Rebel Force Radio. George Lucas, he might not be still working on Star Wars, but he's definitely still in the spotlight as far as we're concerned here at the G-Level Canon headquarters at Rebel Force Radio.
All right, we spoke about it last time. We've got the one-year anniversary. Little Debbie Snack Cakes have been with us here at Rebel Force Radio for a whole year. And as you know, we're giving one case of Little Debbie Cosmic Cupcakes. Actually, two, right? We're giving two cases?
Two cases away.
Two cases away of Little Debbie Cosmic Cupcakes.
Right, each get one case, and that is, as you said, Jason, to celebrate 1 year of Little Debbie and Rebel Force Radio. So through the month of February, two lucky listeners each win a case of Little Debbie Cosmic Cupcakes. They're amazing. I promised you guys last time that we were going to go to the Facebook for our next winner, and we found him. It was a piece of cake when I saw this great graphic Dylan Newhouse created. It's Han, Chewie, Luke. They're in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. But oddly enough, Han is not flying. You know who's sitting in the pilot seat? Little Debbie! She's there with our favorite rebels, and they have a big box of cosmic cupcakes sitting there on the dashboard.
Looks like Little Debbie already bit into hers.
Yeah, she couldn't wait.
Yeah, Hans is undisturbed.
Yep. Well, he's got a big smile on his face, like he's looking forward to it.
He knows what's coming.
You also see the Rebel Force Radio logo featured in this great little graphic whipped up by Dylan Newhouse. So he will be getting a full case of Little Debbie Cosmic Cupcakes, along with our friend from Twitter. His name is Mark T, and Mark T nominated us for a podcast award, podcastawards.com. We should be hearing who is up for who are the finalists for those awards. We should be hearing about that soon. It's award season here, Jason. We're also in contention to become a finalist in the Shorty Awards as best podcast. So that's coming down to the wire, but I think we're looking good. We'll have an update on that next week on Rebel Force Radio. But for now, we are thanking Mark T on Twitter for nominating us for a podcast award and for spreading the word about Little Debbie like he had promised us he would. So I've been following Mark to make sure he'd come through with that, and he did. So he will be getting a case of Little Debbie Cosmic Cupcakes delivered to his door. All you have to do to become eligible is to tweet using the hashtags Little Debbie and hashtag Rebel Force Radio something cool about both of us, let's just say, this show and your favorite treats, Little Debbie. And of course, if you post something on Facebook, be sure to do it at the official page for Little Debbie on Facebook. Be sure to become friends with them and follow them and like them and do all the things you need to do on social media to say it loud and say it proud. You like Little Debbie because Rebel Force Radio likes Little Debbie, and they are the official snack of us here on this very show.
All right. As we said at the top of the program, we have author Mike Climo coming on, and Mike wrote this fascinating essay that's available at StarWarsRingTheory.com. Now, Jim, had you ever heard of the storytelling technique, the ring composition?
Oh, God, no. I never heard of it. But, of course, I heard George Lucas saying over the years that he was crafting the films to play out as if it was a composition, a musical composition. So you would have lyrics repeating themselves. You would have the chorus repeating itself throughout the entire piece. So that's how I've always looked at it, as a musical composition. But the ring composition is an entirely different thing. And loyal Rebel Force Radio Star Wars scholar and ring theory author Mike Climo is our special guest right now on Rebel Force Radio.
The circle is now complete.
Hello.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, good. How are you guys?
Great. Welcome to Rebel Force Radio. Nice to have you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, this is some heady stuff. Okay, so I mean, I'm not used to this kind of thing. You know, normally this type of thing, I click on Facebook and it says, well, because Harrison Ford played both Indiana Jones and Han Solo, they were both related, and somehow Han Solo defeated Hitler. You know, that right. kind of stuff that makes the rounds. Now, this is actually,
I love that meme, by the way. That's very funny.
it's great stuff. And Jim and I were just talking a little bit before we brought you on about this Star Wars ring theory, and the website is StarWarsRingTheory.com. And tell us how this is a legit storytelling technique and ancient, as you call it.
Yeah. So, you know, if I could just kind of back up a second, I guess I'm thinking, you know, we've all noticed, you know, a lot of parallels between, you know, the Phantom Menace and A New Hope and clones and Empire and then Sith and Jedi.
That's right. People tend to draw the comparisons between 1-4, 2-5, and 3-6. And, you know, George has always talked about echoes. He also likens it to music and reprises of themes. So he's certainly been very upfront about kind of borrowing and you know, telling the story from a non-linear point of view in some ways.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and he's always said, you know, he deliberately, you know, did that because he wanted to show Luke and Anakin, you know, essentially going through the same things. You know, they just kind of make different choices. You know, and at one point, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have watched, you know, the beginning documentary on Phantom Menace, and, you know, Lucas compared this to poetry. You know, and of course, Red Letter Media, you know, had a field day with that comment. You know, even though they, you know, it was clear that they didn't, you know, understand at all what Lucas was doing. But, you know, but I like to say that, you know, if you take Lucas's analogy, you know, one step further, and, you know, if you look at the films as a six stanza poem, and each film kind of represents one stanza, then that rhyme scheme, you know, for that pattern is ABC, ABC. But here's the interesting thing, though, is that it turns out that, you know, there was a far more intricate rhyme scheme going on, you know, and it's done so subtly. It's so sophisticated that, you know, big surprise, we all missed it. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it took almost 10 years, you know, from the last movie, you know, for any of us to really understand what Lucas was up to. I mean, it's just really, really, he was ahead of his time with what he was doing here.
Now, you say that this is unlike anything that has ever been done in cinema history. And when you talk about ring theory, you're not talking about Lord of the Rings here. We're talking about a way to align parts of a story so that there's what? What's the purpose of it?
Well, it kind of helps to, you know, if it's okay, just to kind of help explain exactly what ring composition is. Then,
please.
So everybody's kind of on the same page here. So
yes, keep it simple for Jason.
I know. I'm trying. So Lord of the Rings.
He's trying.
I think it's good too. That's always a good. It's a good nickname now for George Lucas. It's probably the Lord of the Rings. You know, after
the real Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. Yeah. So ring composition is this kind of ancient storytelling device that goes back thousands of years, you know, from the epic poetry of Homer to the Bible. And I think we're all already kind of familiar with it. If we, you know, borrow JFK's famous line, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. So that's actually a figure of speech. You know, it's a rhetorical device called chiasmus. It's where the second part of the sentence is a reversal of the first. So, you know, in the first part of the sentence, JFK says country, then you. And in the second part of the sentence, he says you and then country. So if we give each of those words, you know, if we give it a rhyming pattern, it would be ABBA. And ring composition is really just kind of a larger, more complex version of chiasmus. And so what that means is the story's organized into a sequence of elements that goes from a beginning into a midpoint. And then the ring turns, and the first sequence of elements is repeated in reverse order until the story returns to a starting point. So what that means is that the first and the last elements correspond to each other, and the second and second to last elements correspond to each other, and then the third and the third to last elements. So that so the pattern then becomes ABC CBA.
Right.
So this creates kind of a mirror image or a circle, you know, hence the term ring composition.
So when you were watching The Phantom Menace, you weren't seeing it sort of like how we were. We were expecting it to be unfolding in a similar fashion that A New Hope was unfolding. But you discovered there were more connections between the introduction sequences of The Phantom Menace with not A New Hope, but with Return of the Jedi.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think we all watched it and we all saw comparisons to A New Hope. You know, and we, and I think it's only natural. I think, you know, superficially, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the first episodes and the second and the third. But you know, and I think once everything was done, you could really see what was really going on underneath the surface. And that's Phantom Menace corresponds to Return of the Jedi. Attack of the Clones corresponds to The Empire Strikes Back. And Revenge of the Sith corresponds to A New Hope. And what this essentially means is then that that sequence, you know, there are episodes, it starts with The Phantom Menace and it progresses all the way to Revenge of the Sith, where events come to that crucial midpoint, which is essentially the meeting between Obi-Wan and Anakin. And then the ring turns and the first sequence is then repeated in reverse order, bringing the story full circle back to the beginning. And it's really, it's just incredible when you see all these pieces put together. Because, you know, usually, you know, in, you know, traditionally, ring composition, these parallel sections are usually marked with just, you know, with keywords. But what Lucas did is each pair of these corresponding films in the Star Wars ring is matched using practically every aspect of cinema. I mean, narrative structure, plot points, visuals, dialogue, themes, music. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable.
What I like about your website is that you provide photographic evidence that compare things like the opening sequence of The Phantom Menace as the Republic cruiser entered the Trade Federation ship and they requested landing permission. And you see that it plays up against each other so well, but there are subtle changes like camera angles will be reversed from left to right. And so it creates more of a mirror and as opposed to direct storytelling. What you're seeing is more of a mirror image than an actual copy of what we've seen before. You also provide some other photographic evidence. Obi-Wan Kenobi yelling no at the death of Qui-Gon Jinn, very similar to Luke yelling no upon seeing the death of Obi-Wan Kenobi. The arrival on Naboo in the Gungan sacred grounds is much like when the rebels show up at Yavin in A New Hope. So it's, you put it all out there and it's easy to comprehend when you're reading the blog and you have pictures, right, Jason? Pictures always help.
Pictures are good. Pictures are good. So if you wouldn't mind, walk us through, because you do a great job of breaking each film down into its significant parts or acts. Walk us through a little bit of how you make the comparison, which I don't think is as obvious. Jim's pointing out the obvious comparisons of Ep 1 and Ep 4, like you said, sort of the you know, the correlation between each film in terms of its sequence in its particular trilogy. But your talk, like for example, Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi, walk us through how those are structured in a way where they reflect each other.
Sure. So, like you just mentioned, so the opening sequence really is almost kind of a mirror image. But you know, Lucas, you know, he would frequently use that musical analogy, and he would talk about like visual jazz. So he essentially is kind of playing the same song, but maybe changing the arrangement or, you know, the instrumentation a little bit. So if we break down what's actually happening, you know, let's say in the three acts, you know, in The Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi. So in Return of the Jedi, you know, as we all know, it opens, and essentially that first portion of the movie is you have two droids embarking on a mission to rescue Han Solo from Jabba the Hutt's palace. So if you kind of break down exactly what's happening in the first act of The Phantom Menace, it's essentially the same general idea, only he's put a kind of a fresh new spin on it. So now we see two Jedi, instead of two droids, embarking on a mission to essentially rescue a queen from another palace, from Theed Palace.
Whoa.
And then so, and if you kind of follow this into Act Two, you know, a lot of these events, you know, really play out in the same way, where in Return of the Jedi on the planet Endor, you know, the native Ewoks befriend the rebels and help take them to the shield generator, where in The Phantom Menace on the planet Tatooine, a native named Anakin Skywalker, you know, befriends the Jedi and helps them fix their ship. You know, both pictures, you know, in the exact middle of the of each movie, there's a great race. You know, in Jedi, it involves speeder bikes, and in The Phantom Menace, it involves pod racers. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, in the final act of each picture, you have, you know, this kind of primitive race, relatively speaking, you know, joining forces with, you know, the rebels or the Naboo to defeat the Empire and or the Trade Federation in this kind of multi-strand battle. So you can find, you can kind of see, and those are just the kind of big chunks, right? Act one, act two, act three. But like you guys mentioned with that opening sequence, I mean, you can really break this down into these sequences, the scenes, down to, you know, to where the camera is placed, to the blocking of the actors, to the dialogue in the scene, to the use of color. I mean, it's just, it's startling how, you know, the attention to detail here. And it's not done, you know, just for the sake of doing it, right? It's there's, as you kind of go through this essay, and I know it's long, and you know, and I know it's just not for everybody. But if at least if you kind of flip through it, you kind of start to get the idea for why Lucas was doing this. You know, and when you put all the pieces together, it really does form an image. It's not just a ring; it goes much further than just a ring. And you kind of see, you know. You know what I think he was trying to express, you know, by making these movies.
So was this evidence that George Lucas, the experimental filmmaker, never really went away? He just happened to make these experimental films into blockbusters.
That's a fantastic point, right? Because I keep going back to this. You know, there was this interview he did with Richard Corliss from Time Magazine in 2006. It was. And he mentions, you know, offhandedly, you know, what I'm really interested in now is kind of going off and doing more form experimenting. You know, the kind of stuff I did when I was younger, and I'm trying to come up with new ways to tell movies, right? Mm. To tell stories visually. And he was doing it. It's like, to me, it was in 2006, you know, Sith had you know, come and gone, and this was all done. And I think he had just done that, and nobody picked up on it. Right. I mean, he really pushed the art of visual storytelling forward. It was very experimental, never been done before, and we're just now realizing it. And it's just crazy.
When did you decide that this was something of a code within the films, and it was a code that you perhaps could crack?
I don't know. I started noticing things. It was at least a couple of years ago. I mean, it took me a couple of years to put this together. But it wasn't, I mean, it all kind of slowly came into focus. I mean, once, and it actually started with kind of picking up on those kind of, those main points between Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi. The beginning, as soon as I realized the beginnings and the middles and the ends matched, I thought, okay, that's a little strange. You know, like what's going on there? And then I decided to look at the next, you know, set of movies. And then you kind of see the exact same thing happening. Yeah, I mean, it happened, you know, over a pretty long period of time.
Well, Mike, were you familiar with the ring theory or the ring composition technique prior to this? Or did you start to look at these connections between these films and then find out that there was actually a name for this?
I had never really heard of the term ring composition. I was familiar with chiasmus from back in my college days. And so as I was trying to look up, you know, different storytelling devices or different rhetorical devices, I mean, just trying to figure out, you know, what is there a pattern here? Is there something going on? And did he kind of tap into those old techniques like he did with the original trilogy? And I found some work that had been done by a man named John Granger who did something similar, believe it or not, with the Harry Potter books. And that led me to a book called Thinking in Circles, which was, you know, written by this social anthropologist who wrote specifically about ring composition through all the different ancient texts. So as I was reading all these things, suddenly it dawns on you, you know, this is what he's doing. You know, it was just a perfect fit. And I think the evidence is just kind of overwhelming when you go through this essay, and you know, there's literally hundreds of correspondences.
Is there any evidence that George was conscious of doing this?
He's never spoken about ring composition in public, as far as I know. But he's more or less admitted to, you know, obviously, you know, he'll use those analogies of poetry. He'll use the analogies of music. He's definitely commented on repeating, you know, themes and situations, but in, you know, different contexts. But I don't think he's ever come out and talked about the bigger picture, you know, what everything looks like when all the pieces are put together.
This is fascinating. I really feel like you've cracked a code here, and I would love it if someone could find themselves in the position where they could actually ask George if he is aware of the ring composition method, and is it something that he consciously added to create the Star Wars saga as it all unfolded. There is a lot of evidence to provide us with a clear opinion that, yeah, George is aware of that. But before we even go further, we have to talk about perhaps the most significant correspondence that exists between the Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi, and that, of course, is the bodily function humor. What have you discovered?
I thought that, to me, that just kind of made me laugh out loud, because it just kind of shows that, you know, maybe he wasn't taking himself too seriously at all. Or he wasn't taking this whole thing that seriously, right? Where he could at least joke around a little bit about it. And, you know, I know a lot of people, when The Phantom Menace came out, you know, they were just appalled at the idea of, you know, bodily function humor, of poop jokes, you know, in a Star Wars movie. You know, but when you look at it from the viewpoint of the ring composition, you know, if you see that there are two bodily function jokes in The Phantom Menace, and there are two bodily function jokes in Return of the Jedi. You know, you just have them there. They are burp jokes in Return of the Jedi.
All right, let me see if I got this right. In Phantom Menace, you have Jar Jar stepping in a rancor turd as he was walking into Mos Espa. And you also have the pack animal crop dusting Jar Jar later, just prior to the pod race. Then in Jedi, of course, you have the frog dog burping outside of Jabba's palace. You have Jabba letting loose with a couple burps himself, but that's more part of his personality. That isn't really a bodily function gag. But Boba Fett falling into the Sarlacc pit and meeting his demise.
Exactly.
You know, accentuated with a large belch that would make your cousin Joey proud on Super Bowl Sunday. So there we have. We have it doubled up on both Menace, you know,
what I like too is that a lot of these correspondences are inverted in some way. So you actually have, you know, the bodily function right. humor actually being inverted, you know, coming out the other end,
right.
you know, so
perfect.
To speak. So
is that part of the theory? Is that actually in the theory here? I have to pull up that page.
I believe I recall some of Homer's writings.
Yeah, you know, Odysseus, you know, was really into the, you know, the flatulence.
He was very gassy, guy, the Odysseus.
I know he loved that pull my finger gag.
Well, here, I want to put you to the test a little bit here, Mike, because, you know, obviously to most fans. The Empire Strikes Back is almost sacred. It's in some ways it transcends a Star Wars. It defined what it meant to be a successful and meaningful sequel when it wasn't just a regurgitation. But then you have it paired with perhaps the least popular of all the Star Wars films, Attack of the Clones, at least in terms of, I think, what how fan opinion has sort of settled. So what are the correlations and some of the comparisons that you found between those two films?
Well, that was a real eye opener, you know, and one, I just want to say though, that I think Attack of the Clones is just criminally underrated. It's criminally misunderstood. I mean, I think it comes closest to almost what I think what Lucas really tries to do with these movies is you know, give off that feeling of a movie from the 30s and the 40s. But one of the significant things, you know, that I found out, which I thought really was just kind of blew my mind, and I'd never picked up on it before, was, you know, after I saw the, after you see that the beginnings and the middles and the ends of Phantom Menace and Jedi match up, I couldn't see the same thing happening with Clones and Empire. And it turns out that was because Lucas pulled one over on all of us and he flipped it. And what I mean by that is if you take a close look at the opening moments of Clones, you see a large Naboo cruiser and three small escort ships slowly descending into the capital of Coruscant. And if you compare this with near the conclusion of Empire, you know, Luke's dangling from the weather vane under Cloud City, and he's rescued by Leia and Lando, and together they speed away in the Falcon, and they're being pursued by three TIE fighters. So whereas Empire ends with three small ships chasing a large ship that's escaping a city in the clouds, Clones begins with three small ships escorting a large ship that's landing among mile-high skyscrapers, you know, shrouded in dense fog, which is essentially a city in the clouds.
Wow.
And it blew my mind when I discovered that. And I couldn't believe it's just been sitting there right in front of our faces for so long. And I never picked up on it.
If George is listening, he's, I didn't know how smart I was.
Well, I'm a freaking genius. Well, I mean, what do you think? Do you think there could be some dumb luck involved here? Or, I mean, is George really part of the program?
No, I think, I mean, it's like you'll see in the essay, I think there's too many points of correspondences. These things line up sometimes almost you could, you know, like Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi, you can almost at times lay the movies on top of each other and these scenes match up to the minute. And I think it's done on purpose, right? I think, again, it's kind of experimental filmmaking. Part of the reason I think he did this is because by making these connections, you can compare and contrast what's going on in the movies, and you can learn, I think, a lot more than we ever could before. You know, that's kind of a different topic, but I was going to say, you know, once you see that the beginning of Clones matches essentially the end of Empire, you can then see that the end of Clones matches the beginning of Empire, where if you notice that you know, in both cases, you have a giant land battle taking place with, you know, the Republic is attacking the Separatists and the Separatists flee, you know, their hidden base. And then in Empire, you have the Empire attacking the Rebels and the Rebels evacuating their hidden Rebel base. All these things line up to a T. And when you put all the pieces together, you see why he did this.
Wow. That's really incredible. You cracked the code, sir. You cracked the code. There's even examples here of when clones and Jedi seem to walk hand in hand very nicely too. Most notably, the the sequence when Jabba wants to execute Luke at the Sarlacc pit compared to the arena scene on Geonosis.
Yeah, I thought that was really extremely clever of Lucas to do that. You know, up to this point, you know, Empire essentially ends at the end of the second act. The third act of Empire is really that first act of Return of the Jedi, that Jabba's palace sequence. You know, that concludes all those dangling plot threads that took place in Empire. So what Lucas did with the prequels is he basically brought that third act into that second movie. So, you know, when they're on Geonosis and they're in that arena, you start to see all these allusions made to Return of the Jedi. You know, the monsters in the arena, the execution scene, you know, Anakin and Luke are using a green lightsaber for the first time. Padme and Leia actually use a chain as a weapon. You know, even Jango and Boba Fett both roll around in the dirt.
Yes.
And they die after a jetpack malfunction. I mean, the level of detail here is just, it's startling.
Wow. And there's so much more where all that came from, and the website is StarWarsRingTheory.com. Mike, who's been our guest here to kind of break it all down for us. Mike, thank you so much for stopping by and laying this out. I would love, because, you know, I'm very lazy, I would love to hear if you would actually record this in some way and maybe almost make it like an audio essay out of this and, you know, with maybe some clips from the films. I think that would be a great exercise. Not like you don't have anything to do, but I'm just throwing it out there. You know,
Mike, do you do, Mike? I mean, are you a researcher as a profession?
I'm actually a writer. I work in advertising, marketing. You know, when I was younger, I did want to get more into film. You know, I dreamt of being a writer director one day, but you know, life took a funny turn. But you know,
it always does, Mike. It always does. All of us creatives end up going into advertising and marketing.
Unfortunately,
it's where we all go to die.
Slow, agonizing death.
Yikes.
Well, but this is really eye opening, and I just it's so much fun when someone comes along and gives you a whole different way to look at the films. I remember when the discussion was about what order to watch the movies in, you know, and I think the most interesting was the 4-5-1-2-3-6 theory.
The bloody machete order.
Yes. So let me ask you this. Mike, do you have kids?
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old daughter.
3-year-old daughter. So when she gets of Star Wars age, what will be the order that you will show her the films?
You know, I really haven't decided yet.
You going to do it in Ring Theory order?
You know what? I'll probably end up, you know, showing her the movies the way that I saw them, you know, growing up. You know, I think that just, you know, there's just something, you know, maybe nostalgic about it.
Right.
Right.
Yep. And,
maybe just,
of course,
have that same experience that I did.
Yes. And, of course, you're going to be taking her to see The Force Awakens. Will you be keeping notes as you watch the film to maybe apply that to your Ring Theory analysis?
I hope not. And I hope I can just enjoy it and just kind of forget about all this stuff.
Oh, you.
I will say that, you know, I think what I've seen so far, I think it superficially, it looks like it's going to follow that same, at least the same template of The Phantom Menace and A New Hope. I think things are leaning in that direction. You know, but other than that, what's underneath the hood, and you know, are they going to try to make any other connections? I really don't know. We'll both have to wait and see.
Well, everybody, rush out to StarWarsRingsTheory.com, or excuse me, Star Wars Ring One Ring, not rings. Star
don't
Wars
say
Ring
one
Theory.
Ring.
.com.
Don't say not, one ring.
Oh, I'm just getting all kinds of trouble. StarWarsRingTheory.com. Mike Climo has been talking with us here and telling us about how the Star Wars saga, and George Lucas is just a genius in how he used this ancient technique. So, Mike, thanks again so much for stopping by.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, absolutely, my friend.
I just loved it. Thank you.
Take care.
All right, take care, guys.
All right, before we get any further, I do want to take a time out and thank our last sponsor for this week, Dorkside Toys. You know him, you love him. You got to check out Dorkside for all of the latest Star Wars action figures at the very lowest prices around. They got the Black Series, the Saga Legends, the Mission Series, the Master Effects, the new fabrications, and those pop Star Wars vinyl as well. Those are kind of grown on me, the pop vinyl. I'm digging them. They've got just about every brand, every franchise you can imagine. The Star Wars ones are extra cool. But don't forget that you can pre-order your Star Wars action figures at Dorkside. And the best way to do that is to go to shotglassdigital.com and click on the Dorkside banner. And you can see that they have all the pre-orders available. Right now, for example, they have the 3¾-inch Wave 7. Those are on their way. This is the Black Series again. And also Rebels and Star Wars Saga Legends Wave 4. Now, this is a combination where you get some of the classic the Star Wars Saga figures and the limited points of articulation along with the new Rebel figures, like Kanan, for example, and the Inquisitor. So that's Wave 4 of the Star Wars Saga and Rebel Legends. So go over to, like I said, shotglassdigital.com, click on the Dorkside banner, boom, you'll be shopping away, and they just have the best service. They have the best quality control, the figures, everything just comes shipped perfectly right to your doorstep. You don't have to run out to the Target and get disappointed every weekend. You just do it right there at Dorkside Toys, and we thank them so much for their support of us here at Rebel Force Radio.
All right, Jason, this is a segment that we debuted a couple weeks ago when you were MIA.
Mia? What do you know about her?
But this is called Fans Helping Fans, and this is just a little shout-out that we want to give here occasionally on Rebel Force Radio to Star Wars fans in the fan community who are doing great things for other fans. So the first one on this week's list is Yoda's News. We love yodasnews.com here at Rebel Force Radio. They get the word out about each and every Rebel Force Radio show release. Every week, we can count on Mark and the guys at Yoda's News to spread the good word, to say it loud and say it proud about Rebel Force Radio. During the month of February, they have amazing giveaways planned to thank all of their readers. Everyone, for their awesome support over the last 11 years. Because you see, of course, as we are celebrating our anniversary in February with Little Debbie Snacks, Yoda's News has been on the web for 11 years this February. So they have 250 prizes worth over $6,500. And they're giving it all away to casual readers, hardcore readers, you guys, loyal Rebel Force Radio listeners, and everyone who follows them on social media. All you have to do is just keep your eyes open and go to yodasnews.com for more information, because you can find out how you can win things like a Kotobukiya Han Solo and Chewbacca statue, a Stormtrooper premium format figure by Sideshow, the gentle giant Yoda Ilum statue. Jason, I think you're a big fan of that one.
Love that one.
That's a great piece. Hasbro figures, gentle giant Kenner 12-inch jumbo figures, Uncle Milton, more sideshows, Clone Wars figures, incredible stuff. So yodasnews.com, tell Mark and the guys over at Yoda's News, good job, and you heard all about them here on Rebel Force Radio. Another great shout-out. You know, shout-outs are always nice. Yoda's News gives shout-outs for Rebel Force Radio every week, and we pay them back in kind. And another brand new source of Star Wars information on the internet has arrived. This is probably the biggest thing to happen to Star Wars news on the internet ever, because I'm talking about a new podcast called The Younglings Podcast. I heard all about it from their dad, Mariano, who said, "Hi, Jason and Jimmy, a loyal listener here, along with my kids. In fact, the kids were inspired by you guys to create a Star Wars podcast for their school project. Their first episode is premiering tomorrow, And I'm giving you guys an advance listen because there's a special part for you at the 42nd mark. Thanks again for all the great work you guys do. So Mariano is a proud papa, and he is doing the right thing. He is nurturing the next generation of Star Wars fans. That's what all Star Wars parents should do. Jason, I know you're doing that.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Got the shelf up in the boys' room.
Perfect.
Go through all the characters every night.
Oh, it all starts with a shelf.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, Rancho Obi-Wan. But we could only hope. But, you know, Mariano, he's a great dad, and his kids have created the Younglings Podcast. And you can find it at the younglingspodcast.wordpress.com. It's special because it's kids hosting a Star Wars podcast for kids. And here is a little sample of the Younglings Podcast and the very cool shout-out they gave to us here at RFR.
Today in Younglings, we'll go through the story of our podcast. Tessa will do the Star Wars news, and we'll even have a teaser trailer discussion. I bet all of you are wondering how this podcast got started. The Younglings podcast was started while me and my dad were on the road listening to Rebel Force Radio. We like that podcast. Hey, Jimmy Mac. Hey, Jason. Just wanted to give a hello to them. We did this podcast because we realized that there were no Star Wars podcasts by kids. Four kids. So our main goal is to reach the little youngling geeks.
Aww. That is precious.
That is good. Inspired by RFR, too.
Yeah.
So thank you for the shout out. We're hearing you guys, and we are supporting all of your efforts at the Younglings Podcast. I don't know if we should support them. They're going to knock us off the map if we're not too careful.
Well, they sound more mature than we do sometimes. Tell you that.
Thank you so much, Mariano. We're very proud of you for being a great Star Wars dad. Another guy who gave us a very cool shout out is DJ Willie Wow. We debuted his song Yoda Loves Jazz here on Rebel Force Radio a couple weeks ago, and he's a big Star Wars fan. And to pay tribute to Rebel Force Radio, he gave us a shout out in his latest and greatest tune. It's called A New Hope Freestyle. This is DJ Willie Wow. Here's an excerpt from that song, especially the Rebel Force Radio parts. And you're hearing it here on RFR.
Rhyme writer, X-Wing fighter, red leader, gold leader, Luke felt alone. Without his teacher, the Force has always been with him, way before he sold his speeder. Vader's on his tail, he felt the Force was strong. Didn't see the Falcon in his rear view. Shot Vader into space. Woo-hoo! Blast it, kids, let's go home. Shot the protons, the Death Star blew up like a giant bomb. This is for the cool dads, the cool moms, who love Star Wars. DJ Weewow, Rebel Force Radio. Here we go. A New Hope. That's the way the story goes.
Wow. That's awesome.
That's great stuff.
That's awesome. So give DJ Willie Wow a little love on Facebook. You can find him at facebook.com/DJ Willie Wow. That's Willie, W-I-L-L-Y. So thank you for all the support. Fans helping fans. That's what we like to promote here at Rebel Force Radio.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
All right. Don't say we didn't warn you. Yes, we're going to do our spoiler update. It's more like a review, I suppose, if you're following the spoilers online. And these are spoilers, guys. These are plot points. These are character fates that we're talking about in context with what's being speculated and reported from the set of Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. So, as we say, please, please, please don't say we didn't warn you.
Yes.
So here's the rules. We set the egg timer. Jim, do you have it?
I do. I have the old school analog egg timer from Amco. There it is.
We set it for 15 minutes.
It's ancient, it's rusty, but if I struggle, I can set it. at 15 minutes. So pardon us if all times are approximate, but we might be missing a second or two here along the way. But this is pretty exciting because there are huge spoiler rumors this week. So in 3, 2, 1, we're going to launch it.
Right.
3, 2, 1, we're off.
All right. From Making Star Wars, big, big spoiler here. You can't get much bigger than a major character dying. Yes. Could it be true? Recent rumors that have leaked out of Pinewood Studio to Making Star Wars. These are, as they call them, facts. These are the facts that this was shot at Pinewood. A sequence takes place on the ramparts of the Evil Castle.
Yeah, I think that the Evil Castle represents probably the interior of what was shot in Ireland. Skellig Michael.
Right, that little island.
Yes.
Where it was rumored that Luke Skywalker has either been imprisoned by others or imprisoned by himself, but that's where he is hiding out.
Right, and when you say imprisoned by himself, that means he is guarding the entrance to an ancient Sith tomb.
Yes, yes.
From what we've been hearing.
And Han Solo is hiding. He's hiding in the Evil Castle. He decides to reveal himself to Kylo Ren. Finn, Rey, Chewbacca, and BB-8 stop in their tracks. They watch as Han Solo confronts Ren. Ren silences the conversation forever. Chewbacca lets out a barrage of angry roars and laser bolts. Kylo Ren flees the scene. Explosions ensue. Stormtroopers file in, and Finn and Rey are forced to flee. More explosions. BB-8 and Chewbacca flee to the Falcon. Han Solo, never in a scene after this. These are the facts, according to Making Star Wars. Now, Jim, this isn't the first time we've heard rumors of Han dying in Episode 7. But
no.
The first round of rumors got debunked, and it turned out that he would live to another day and that we would see Harrison Ford as Han Solo in Episode 8. So is this poo-doo, or is the Force strong with this?
Wow. Reliable source, Making Star Wars, I guess. I mean, we haven't seen the film yet, so we don't know if anything they've been reporting is right or wrong. But the Han Solo death rumor was in place firmly, I think, the day this film was announced. So it could be a smokescreen playing off of that. We've heard also from other sources that Han Solo does not die in The Force Awakens. So I don't know what to believe here.
Could they have shot this for Episode 8 in advance?
No, I wouldn't see that happening, because this isn't a situation where you're dealing with a director who is moving on to the next film. We know Rian Johnson is handling all that, but no, I mean, stranger things have happened, so you can't rule that out, of course. We've heard these stories about Han Solo being assassinated, maybe even by Luke Skywalker.
Right.
As he tries to do the right thing or something like that, or Han makes a sacrifice so the others could escape. This sounds more like, and I think Making Star Wars made the same connection I'm going to. It seems like it plays out very much like when Obi-Wan was struck down on the Death Star.
Ah, like a sacrifice in a sense.
Like a sacrifice in a sense.
Wow.
I'm almost relieved hearing this rumor, because, God, I don't want Luke Skywalker to kill Han Solo. No matter what happens, I just don't want that to happen.
See, that soured me. When I heard that it was a possibility or a rumor, that soured me for days. It was just hard to shake.
This is such a hardcore little bit of information to be released, especially if it turns out to be true. Who knows what else we're going to be hearing about this film, but this is a big one. This is a massive, massive leak.
Yes. I'm going to go with poo-doo on this. I think Disney is smart enough to realize that they need to keep the original trio intact for as long as possible. I think that Harrison Ford has signed on for 2 films and that if he does meet his demise, it'll be in episode 8, not episode 7. I say poodoo.
Poodoo!
Fair enough. Fair enough. Something about this sort of stacks up. And I know, I think the Force is strong with this one.
All right.
The Force is strong with this one.
All right. Han Solo, dead. Who strikes first? Well, we know who strikes last.
We have more. We have more rumors.
We do.
We're going to take a break from the infamous spoiler boy rumors this week and get into more rumors that have been getting revealed from Making Star Wars and their source.
All right. Rey and Luke go into hiding at exactly the same time for the same reason. She is the daughter of Han and Leia, and she's tasked with protecting a lightsaber that can open a proverbial Pandora's box of evil. Artifacts being sought after by Kylo Ren, collected because they're trying to figure out which artifact will open the tomb. Luke Skywalker is guarding the tomb and being tormented by evil spirits that appears half-crazed from the duties for the duty he's been on. Okay, so not unlike what we saw with Darth Maul maybe a little bit in the Clone Wars. But in this case, they're saying that Luke Skywalker is guarding the tomb of a Sith, and Kylo Ren is out there looking for artifacts. This is a little Harry Potter-ish, actually, looking for artifacts because one of them will be the key to unlocking the tomb. And Rey believes that it could be this lightsaber, so she's protecting it. Now, Jim, we've been told that this lightsaber that comes tumbling down from the far reaches of space could be Luke's lightsaber from his confrontation with Vader on Cloud City that he loses.
It could be.
But let us not forget, that's not really Luke's lightsaber. I consider Luke's lightsaber to be the green one that he constructs on Tatooine prior to the events of Return of the Jedi, whereas the lightsaber that he loses is Anakin Skywalker's lightsaber.
Right.
So is that the key? I'm digging this whole notion. I love the idea of a half-crazed Luke Skywalker. Not as fun as Crazy Mace, but still... still a fun idea. I think the Force is strong with this.
I like this one, too. It does sort of stack up well with some things we've been hearing behind the scenes. I love the opportunity to see an insane Luke Skywalker because, of course, that gives you the opportunity to use Mark Hamill's brilliant skills as the Joker, the voice of the Joker, and bring that wicked cackle to Star Wars, which is something I've been dying for.
Well, you know, you're right. It does definitely take advantage of Luke's versatility. You know, clearly in the early days, he was, well, I mean, he's still a nice looking man, don't get me wrong, but he was kind of had that heartthrob thing going on there in the days of Corvette Summer and A New Hope. And now, you know, he's matured into more of a character actor. And so this type of role would fill it well. Plus, let's not forget that he is an echo of Obi-Wan or Ben Kenobi, who was a crazy wizard. So that's, we might see some of that crazy wizard going on with Luke.
Long gone are the days of feathered hair blowing in the wind. We're dealing with crazy Luke with that crazy contractually obligated beard that has a life of its own. And there are going to be certain characters, I'm sure, living within that beard.
All right, and why doesn't that beard have a Twitter account?
The beard should have a Twitter account. I threw it out there. Nobody's reached out to me from Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill's beard, I think. Right. That's what it is. Mark Hamill's beard.
Domhnall Gleeson was a rebel for many years, and he's the son of, quote-unquote, a huge character. But he defected to the Empire when he learned that the rebels had constructed a super weapon in secret. With less than honorable people in the Rebel Alliance now, Gleeson's character is tasked with hunting Finn while also on a secret mission to destroy both super weapons of the Empire and the Rebels.
So two super weapons, dueling Death Stars. Now that would be interesting to see a dogfight between two Death Stars.
Yeah.
It'd be like watching turtles wrestle.
Yeah, I was thinking something almost Borg-like from Star Trek. Remember the Borg cubes?
Yeah.
Well, these would be the round ones.
Wrong answer.
Wrong! Yes. I don't know. You know, it sounds like all these characters are the son or daughter of someone.
Remember, the Star Wars universe is and always has been a very small place.
Yes, and incestuous at times.
Sometimes.
I'll go with this. I like the idea of corruption in the Rebel Alliance. That's an interesting idea. You know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So I can imagine that once the Rebel Alliance was in charge of the galaxy, that clearly it brings out maybe the not so nice side of a lot of people. Could Domhnall Gleeson be the son of Wedge?
No, wrong. We've heard behind the scenes that Gleeson's character, though he is an Imperial, is actually the son of Luke Skywalker. Yes. And I'm sure, I think that's been reported online as well. But we've definitely heard before that was posted online that that was what was happening. So I say the Force is strong with this one.
Okay. All right. Gwendolyn Christie is Gleeson's lead shock trooper. She's a chrome trooper with black and red cape that is hunting Finn. She uses a lightsaber, is arrogant, demeaning, and kills indiscriminately. Her face is heavily scarred, and she has a military haircut and has the ability to cloak herself. We've actually seen what we believe are photos of this. I say it's true.
Yeah, yeah. The Force is strong with this one. This one all adds up very much as well. We do believe that she is working under Domhnall Gleeson's character. And by the way, Domhnall Gleeson, someone did a great mock-up of him in the Imperial officer uniform. And this guy has the cheekbones. He could even come off as maybe even a descendant of Tarkin just by the dead stare and the high cheekbones.
Hmm.
But from what we have been hearing is that he is Luke Skywalker's son.
Luke Skywalker's son. All right. What do we got next here? Luke is in hiding. Now, this isn't the first time we've heard this. During much of The Force Awakens, he has put himself in a self-imposed exile, protecting an ancient Sith tomb from being opened by the main bad guy, Kylo Ren. Now, what we saw in the trailer was,
there has been an awakening.
Ooh.
Camp. I felt it.
That's good, man.
Yeah. So
practicing.
So there you go. So the awakening, is this the awakening of whatever is inside that tomb? And that is what is calling Kylo Ren to open it up. This is all starting to jive with what we've seen and what we're hearing. It is true that a simple lightsaber leads the trio to Han, but what isn't mentioned is that Han is extremely reluctant to allow his daughter to be part of this plan. And this is Rey. Rey is Han Solo's daughter, and over the course of the film, we learn she is in love with Poe, and Han does not approve. Well, why would he?
You know why he doesn't approve is because the character of Poe is going to remind Han way too much of himself.
Yes, every dad's worst nightmare for their daughter.
That's right, and I believe Han does certain things to enforce the fact that Poe doesn't have the experience that he believes he has, and does things like calls him kid and acts derogatory toward him in a similar way to how he originally treated Luke early on in A New Hope.
Yeah, I'm thinking that the Force is strong with this one. And again, I can't say enough that what I'm hearing, what I'm reading here, is some very interesting and cool, compelling plot points. So I'm jazzed with what I'm seeing. Apparently, there's a scene in which Finn is trying to shoot a blaster, and he is awful. So this is a little in-joke about how inept stormtroopers were in the original trilogy.
From what I understand, Finn is a pacifist, and he was drafted against his will into the Imperial Army.
That's it.
That's all? Wow, I think we packed a lot into this spoiler report, this spoiler alert. It's getting interesting. It's getting really interesting. It
right, that's going to wrap things up for this week here on Rebel Force Radio. Lots of things we jam-packed in this program, especially the spoiler segment. You don't want to... you don't have to listen to that more than once. You might want to rewind that. A lot of good stuff there. Big thanks to our guests also, Henry Gilroy and Mike Climo. You can check out Mike's theories over there at StarWarsRingTheory.com. And, of course, our sponsors for this week, Dorkside Toys and Little Debbie Snack Cakes. As always, we thank them. They help make this show possible. If you'd like to play with us in between shows, you can do so. Just drop an email, show@RebelForceRadio.com. In the voicemail line, 708-320-1737. That's 708-320-1RFR. The Twitter, we're all on the Twitter. Rebel Force Radio can be found at Rebel Force Radio. Jimmy Mac Radio and just plain old Jason Swank. Facebook, our Facebook page over there at Facebook. You just search for Rebel Force Radio. You'll find it. Breaking news, links to stories, and just great conversation by a community of folks and contributors that you just won't find anywhere else. I can tell you that. iTunes, they're still around. Getting a facelift, I think. That's what I hear. It's still the number one source for podcasts anywhere. It's just they're chock full. They're the only ones that have as complete a directory of podcasts as they do. Also, you can subscribe and review not just Rebel Force Radio, but all of the podcasts at the Shot Glass Digital Network. Just one rule.
Make it good.
The official website for Rebel Force Radio can be found at RebelForceRadio.com, and we do invite you to check out ShotGlassDigital.com for all of the podcasts, part of the Shot Glass Digital empire. And we'd appreciate a little like on the Facebook page as well for Shot Glass Digital. If you'd like to stream the show, you can do that just about each and every Saturday night. Internet radio station, srsounds.com, that's Sorcerer's Radio. srsounds.com, that's 7 p.m. Eastern time. So tell your friends. All right, we'll see you next time. Clicking the weeks, the months away. We got Celebration 7 weeks away. Woo. Force Awakens just a scant 10 months away.
Woo!
We'll see you next time. Love you all so much. For Rebel Force Radio, I'm Jason.
And I'm Woo!
And remember,
the Force will be with you always.
Clear, kid!